yourself, ma'am, on who you are. We did receive your CV, we did read, but just tell us other things that you might not know about yourself that are quite interesting. Then thereafter, the honorable members individually will ask you questions, and you will be expected to respond to each and every question. I will now give over to you, ma'am, and please talk to us about yourself. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Honourable Tolashe, and good afternoon to the honourable members that are part of this ad hoc committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present myself for consideration for this position. I am grateful for the opportunity to do so. My name is Sakani Maluleke. I have been working in the office of the AG for the last 8 years, just over 8 years. And who I am is that I am a South African, first and foremost. I am passionate about this country and its prospects. I am a professional auditor and accountant in particular, but a professional that's not only committed to technical excellence in what I do, but one that's embraced the key responsibility that I believe every professional should have, especially given the role we're supposed to play in society. Society invests in all of us as professionals, and society has particular expectations on how we're going to show up in the execution of our work. Not only should we be technically competent, but we should act in the public interest. We should be acting to help to build society, to help to deliver on the promises that society has, the expectations that society has when they invest in us. We're part of an elite class in society, and the expectation is that we should make good on the investment made in us and act in a way that builds. I hold very dear the key principles that underpin what professional accountants should do. Over and above acting in the public interest, we're required to be independent in our approaches to our work. We're required to act with integrity at all times. And we're also required to act with due care when we execute our duties. The second thing I want to share about me is that I have a rather overdeveloped sense of duty. Perhaps it is about being a firstborn, and I carry that in all that I do. However, when I reflect on why that is and why that has informed my choices in career and in where I choose to invest my time and give expression to my talents, it's really about having observed how my own parents executed their own careers, how they showed up in the world. My father was an attorney for many years, and he completed his career as a member of the judiciary. But having observed him, and I'm a typical daddy's girl, I found that he wasn't given to focusing on accumulating wealth. He was concerned about adding value to society, and those are the values that he espoused and what he passed on to me. And I think it informs the sense of duty that I have. If I look at my own mother, she was a school teacher for many years, and school teachers are a key asset to the nation, and they contribute in a very special way. My mother is born of two medical doctors, Drs. Refilwe Zele and Peter Zele, who, yes, they were medical doctors in apartheid South Africa, which says something about their intellectual talents. But they were also very involved in their communities. They were seized with adding value to society, seized with looking after the more vulnerable in society. And that's what informs my sense of duty. The third aspect about me is that I put people at the center of the things that I do. Not just people internally, in terms of the work I do every day, but also I worry about the impact of my work on other people, broader than what I can see. And that's what informed my career choices and what I do on a daily basis. I'm a woman, I'm a female leader, and if you look at the world now, the women leaders of nations that seem to be winning the battle against the COVID-19 pandemic and its impact on society, on economies, on livelihoods, and on lives, they seem to be demonstrating some very noticeable common features. Empathy, compassion, a respect for science. They communicate well. And those are the characteristics that are common to me. That's what I seek to develop even more, because that's the natural way in which I lead, and that's the way that I think the world calls upon us to lead in. So, Honorable Tolashe, this is who I am. I've chosen to shape my career in the way that I have because of these characteristics, these passions, these values. And that's what informs how I show up in the world and how I show up with what I do.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. We are now going to give over to Honorable Spies for her to start asking. Honorable Vessels, I'm sorry, for you to start asking questions. Oh, Honorable Singh. At least I've pronounced the surname correctly. That was a lighter note. Honorable Vessels, can you please put your question over to you, ma'am? Say.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, ma'am. The Office of the Auditor General is a reputable office that has been around for a century, but times are changing. Circumstances in South Africa are changing. We are facing dire economic circumstances, dire socio-economic circumstances, and also the founding legislation governing the Office of the Auditor General has recently changed. Taking that into account, how do you see the focus areas for the Office of the Auditor General for the next decade? In the short term, the medium term, and the long term. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Vessels. Ms. Maluleke, can you please respond?
Thank you, Honorable Vessels. Thank you. It's going to be pretty hard, Honorable Vessels, to give you a clear sense of what the office will look like in 10 years. I think a long-term range is very difficult to predict right now given the inherent uncertainties and ambiguities that the whole world is dealing with. What I can tell you, though, is that in the long range, what will be consistent about the office are the things that have made it strong and have kept it as a credible institution within our society. It is those pillars about independence, about professionalism, and about relevance. And if I look at independence, the office, as you rightly say, had its enabling legislation amended over the past year, which essentially gave the Auditor General the power and responsibility to follow up on the implementation of his or her recommendations following its annual audit. Those amendments have essentially added onto the arsenal of the good things about the independence of the office. If one compares the things that define the independence of the office against other supreme audit institutions across the world, we certainly compare very well. And that's what we would need to make sure we protect and continue to build on. The other thing around professionalism is, if I cut it up into two parts, it's about the skills and capacity that sit within the office, which essentially South Africans have invested in. It's about the diversity of talent that is there, the technical skills that are there. It's about the capabilities of the office. If I look at also within the context of professionalism, it's about how the office runs in a way that is professional, that leads by example in terms of its own transparency, accountability, good governance, essentially doing those things it expects of other institutions to do. Another feature that we often miss in this part about leading by example is acting as a good and responsible corporate citizen within South Africa, one that understands its responsibilities to build skills, to build talent, to transform, to define what a responsible South African citizen, corporate citizen looks like. So those two things would remain firmly in place and would be protected, and that's important because that's what South Africans will expect. The third aspect of what I think will remain a feature of the office is a quest to grow the relevance of the work that we do. We do very well in this regard. I think we have a wonderful opportunity to continue to build on that. Essentially, my sense is that the office needs to be developing and closing the gap in not just what citizens understand we do, but making sure that citizens can link the essence of the work that we do with their lived experience. And to me, that's really about entering that space more and more around the relevance of the work that we do. So if I have it my way, as a South African and one who's vested in the office, if the next 5 years would be about protecting those two pillars that are so firm right now and continuing to build on the last one on relevance. And you're not going to be able to do that unless you keep the first two completely intact. If I think about the short term, and unfortunately that's where we are, the inherent ambiguities that confront us require that all leaders think carefully about surviving in the short term and maintaining their institutional capabilities and maintaining their delivery and their excellence in the short term with all the threats that confront us. The fiscus is under immense pressure. The health of South Africans is under threat. And that has a consequential impact on the office, not just in terms of the finances that it has access to run its affairs, but also in terms of the nature of the work that it can do. And so the short term, it is about figuring out how do you remain resilient as an institution? How do you keep your people focused on the tasks at hand? And how do you keep them safe and well, not just physically but mentally too, so that you maintain the capability for them to deliver on the mandate of the office? Right now in the short term, you've got basically three big audit cycles, and they are huge. And anyone who takes over, if I'm appointed and I take over on the 1st of December, my focus will be on making sure that we maintain the focus of the individuals that work for the Office of the AG on delivering on those three big things, which is a PFMA cycle that's got the implementation of the Public Audit Act amendment, which is a big deal for the office, a big game changer, and it's about making sure that we deliver on this instrument that the legislators have trusted us with. Two, we've got these COVID-19 audits that we're doing as a special audit as part of our relevance quest. And it's a big thing for us. It's about taking the professionalism that we've built over time and deploying it in a way that's going to benefit South Africans and make sure that we respond to the needs and wants of our stakeholders. And then we've got an MFMA cycle that comes soon after that. And all of these cycles are delayed. So there's immense pressure on the people, on the institution, and whoever leads it needs to know that protecting that which is strong about the institution is a key priority, whilst we focus then on the medium-term and the longer-term strategies. Thank you, Honourable Thistle.
Thank you very much, Ms. Maluleke, on those responses. We're now going to give over to Honourable Singh for him to please pose your question, Honourable Singh. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, and good afternoon to you, Honourable Ms. Maluleke. But we're all honourable people, I take it. You've been around long enough to be able to tell this committee what do you think are the key challenges facing our country at the moment, and what role do you think the Auditor General can play in strengthening South Africa's democracy and dealing with these challenges, and courtesy of Honourable Buthelezi, in strengthening democracy, the transformation of the auditing profession.
Thank you very much, Honorable Singh. Back to yourself, Ms. Maluleke.
Thank you, Honorable Singh. As South Africa deals with this economic crisis that confronts us, we had a difficult set of economic circumstances even before the pandemic, and the pandemic has made things even worse. So there's an urgency for us to deal with the key challenges within our society: poverty, unemployment, inequality, the capacity of key institutions to deliver on the promises to South Africans. And not just key institutions in the public sector, but also in the private sector, because I do believe that ultimately those are created to deliver some value to society. The moment has created a sharp focus by all the social partners on the need for collective action in response to these challenges, for action in response to these challenges, and an ownership of the challenges such that we all accept that no one is going to solve these things alone. Government can't do it alone. We need to make sure that there is adequate partnership and consistent collaboration in pursuit of a common purpose. Essentially, we need a new social compact. And the only way you're going to do that is by building trust. And for me, trust is underpinned by a commitment to transparency, to performance and delivery, to accountability, and ultimately to maintaining the integrity of institutions. Without trust, we're not going to build the social compact we need, and we're not going to get the collective action on our challenges. Without trust, we're not going to get South Africans to accept that these are our collective problems, which need all of us to accept that we are all in it together and we must deal with it. If I think about the role of the audit office, it's mandated to enhance the systems of integrity, of accountability, of transparency, and it is, those are set out in the Constitution, and set out in more specific terms in the enabling legislation. And my view is the office needs to continue to do what it does, deliver on this mandate, but do so in a way that's even more responsive to the current need. And the only way the office is going to do more of this work in a more responsive way is by being in tune with the needs of society, understanding its stakeholders even more than what we do now, and so that we can be responsive, working collaboratively with other partners, the civil society organizations, working more collaboratively with business so that we can find solutions to the things that trouble the route to more efficient and effective delivery by the state. Working more closely with other people right across society, including these private sector firms. So if you're asking me about what role should the profession play more broadly, I do think that it's unhelpful to think of the profession with public sector and private sector being too distinct. Our office is a central part of the profession. We have the biggest training scheme of the profession. We employ 680 chartered accountants on a full-time basis, and we rely on the input of the firms to help us deliver on our mandate. So we're an integral part of the profession. I think that the private sector profession needs to be reminded much more readily and actively and loudly of its role in building society. For far too long, I think the private sector auditors have forgotten that their job is to act in the public interest. Their undertaking, as set out in the Code of Ethics, is to serve in the public interest. And for too long, I'll talk about the full profession. We've seen the private sector firms do less and less of work that is in the public interest and start to have a posture that's more about commercial gain. And it's a difficult balance. But we have to find every way to advocate for the profession to find its way back to putting public interest at the center of what they do. If we do that, we won't struggle with regulation, we won't struggle with codes of conduct and disciplinary action in the way that we do now. you'll start to have a step change in terms of how people show up in the execution of their duties. And they'll start to think much more broadly than one client, one audit report, one financial report, and then signature on that that's very narrowly focused. They'll think about the entire system and the impact of the signature that they put as an assurance provider on financial statements.
Thank you so much, Ms. Maluleke. We'll now go to Honorable de Villiers. Allow Mr. Honorable de Villiers to pose your question. Thank you, sir. Over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good afternoon, Ms. Maluleke. It's nice to have you here. I think my question very nicely links in with the comments which you've just made, where you've explained that private sector audit firms actually should be acting in public good. But unfortunately, as we all know, in the last 5 years, we've seen massive publicity around private sector corruption and massive accounting fraud based around private businesses that have been audited by these private firms. And ultimately, the audit profession itself has lost a bit of credibility and has been damaged in the process. So my role, and you also very nicely acknowledged the very important role that the Auditor General's office and the whole institution plays in the auditing sector. So my question to you is, what role does the Auditor General then have in restoring the trust and the confidence of the public in the audit profession itself?
Thank you, Honourable de Villiers.
Proceed, ma'am.
Thank you. The Auditor General, being a central part of the profession, has a role to play in two ways. One is to lead by example in demonstrating that the things we talk about as expectations of private sector firms, we do as well, and to share our experiences in that regard. And maybe one might say that it's easier for us to do because we're not a commercial enterprise. But at the same time, we are a professional outfit in many ways, and we can share experiences. So it's about leading by example in those areas. The second role that the Auditor General would play is by advocating for the right things. Advocating for the key principles and values that must inform how the private sector audit firms engage with their work. And you would have seen us do this quite actively when we decided to terminate the mandate of KPMG and Gongi at a particular point in time. And that was a difficult decision. And we made that because we became quite clearly focused on the values that must underpin the profession, because we know them. We've grown up in the profession. We're an integral part of the profession. And we were clear about the notion that making that decision would have a direct impact and an indirect impact on a broad range of stakeholders. But that notwithstanding, it was important to take a stand around the things that must be a dominant feature of how the profession shows up. So for me, it's really about those two things. Demonstrate that it is possible and share learnings in that regard. And two, advocate for the right things and do so actively. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Maluleke. It will now take us to Honorable Somyo. For Honorable Somyo to please pose his question. Over to you, Honorable Somyo.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Good afternoon, Ms. Maluleke. You have taken a trouble to apply for this position, to play your role within an institution which has been born out of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, with its own key tenet as a staying independent and playing that role quite efficiently. Now, if you are fortunate to be appointed as an Auditor General, how would you keep that constitutional injunction and ensure that over the life of the institution you strengthen the independence of the Office of the Auditor General? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Somyo. Can you come back to you, Ms. Maluleke? Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honorable Somyo. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Indeed, the independence of the office is one of the safeguards for our democracy, and it's something to be protected, it's something to be valued, not just by the people who work within the office, but by all stakeholders that have a vested interest in the success of our democracy. As Auditor General, what I would do to maintain that, to protect that, would be five things, and I'll list them as I go. The first one is, as a leader, I would have to demonstrate through example that these values of independence are non-negotiable. Because people often follow what you do, not so much what you say. And it's imperative that as a leader of the office, I'm seen and experienced to be prioritizing ethical conduct, independent approaches to the work that we do. The second thing is really about the leadership. So the leadership team and I would have to similarly espouse those values and pass them on and talk about them all the time so that the people we lead internally have an appreciation of the importance of independence so that it's not something that they take for granted ever. And I was lucky in that when I arrived at the office, that was one of the central things that the Auditor General spoke about all the time. And 8 years ago, I didn't have an appreciation of it as fine as what I do now. The fourth thing is we'd have to set about highlighting and continuing to highlight the professionalism with which we've got to do our work. Because the good thing about auditors is that independence as a concept and independence as a value and as a principle is something we are all taught right from the beginning of our academic journey and our training journey. And it's really about making sure that the professionals that work within the office uphold this principle that they've been told, that they've been taught. It's not a foreign thing. But we've got to make sure that there are consistent conversations about it and we keep it front and center of the work that we do. The fourth thing I would do is create the institutional capacity to monitor any threats to such independence. And it's really about any threats to our reputation, any threats to the quality of work we do, any threats to individuals who within the office who may act in a way that's inconsistent with the rules that we would have set. So it's about making sure that we have clearly set out rules, but the capacity to monitor ongoing compliance, to detect anything that goes wrong, and to respond to it in a way that's predictable and act when things do go wrong quickly, because we've got to maintain the reputation. And the last thing I would do is keep highlighting to external stakeholders the need for them to hold us accountable, because it is when external stakeholders also believe and experience us to be upholding these principles around independence that we will know that we're doing what we're supposed to do. And they're probably the ones who, if they are vested in the journey of maintaining this independence because it is such an asset to democracy, they are the first ones to highlight any risks or highlight any threats in a way that we can jointly respond to. So those are the things I would do, Honorable Somyo. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Maluleke. To make us to go now to Honorable Peters for her to pose her question. Over to you, Honorable Peters.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good afternoon, Ms. Maluleke. I have heard you give an indication of some of the values and principles that you imbibed from a very early childhood in terms of what your father and mother and your family gave to you, and I thought about something. When during the time of the pronouncements by the state president with regard to the interventions that the country would make in ensuring that the impact of COVID-19 or coronavirus is minimized on the citizenry of South Africa, There were others who, whilst people were worried about their health and well-being, others were sitting and salivating about the amounts that the president were pronouncing in. And we have seen the emergence of COVID-19 corruption allegations. As in the next incoming Auditor General, what would you do to deal with these particular challenges, in particular in situations of procurement? I would want to say any procurement opportunity that is presented to the Republic of South Africa becoming a potential avenue for corruption. What is it that you believe you could be able to do to deal with this, but also how would you advise that those that you will be auditing or your auditees to make it possible that they can mitigate against this for future procurement opportunities that might be presented by any situation? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Tipuwa. Back to you, Ms. Maluleke. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dealing with corruption and malfeasance in the context of procurement, especially in an emergency situation, is always going to be very difficult. I understand your question to be saying beyond even the COVID-19 crisis, what would one do as an audit office and what would one advocate for amongst auditees to do in terms of dealing with the potential for leakage? My sense of this is that it's not a quick fix. The things we've got to do are about, first of all, being clear about what the ethical posture of the leadership of those institutions ought to be. And leadership for me goes right to the very top. So we've got to be clear that the very values that are set out in Section 195 of the Constitution in terms of how public administration shall run, those are what, it is against those that we hold all leaders accountable. Because political leaders that are elected and those that are appointed ultimately to run government as administrators, they hold that responsibility to uphold those values. And we've got to hold them accountable to that. Those values must inform the posture with which public administration runs. If I start at particular auditees, the very top of it would be an accounting officer. Section 38 of the Public Finance Management Act sets out what an accounting officer ought to do. And that's where we've got to focus, making sure that accounting officers not only have the ethical posture, but they clearly set out the rules within which procurement will happen in their environment, and that those rules must be consistent with Section 217 of the Constitution. They set out systems that will predictably prevent non-compliance, detect it, and provide them with an opportunity to correct it. The third thing accounting officers need to do is ensure that when things do go wrong, because things will go wrong on occasion, but when things go wrong, they act and they apply consequences, because that's what a good internal control environment is about. It's about the values and the posture. It's about clear rules that are set out. It's about systems and processes that help you detect and prevent non-compliance. And it's about acting when things do go wrong and acting quickly in a way that's transparent, that's consistent. And that's how you shield the environment from impunity. That's how you shield the environment from people who seek to do wrong. So my advice to accounting officers would be, let's sit back and look at your duties as set out in the Act. Let's work with you to design the controls that help you do this. And let's make sure that you hold yourself accountable to that and that your political principle holds you accountable to that. I would also have conversations with the executive authorities about this very same thing, that if an accounting officer isn't given the space to do their work in a way that's consistent with the Act, that's a problem which will ultimately taint you as a political principal in that environment. So it is in your interest to work with the accounting officer and give them space to not just design but to implement the internal controls that are going to safeguard resources. Thank you, Honorable Peter.
Thank you, Ms. Maluleke. The next question will come from Honorable Morolong.
Well, thank you very much. Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. Good afternoon, Ms. Maluleke. What do you anticipate to be potential impediments in the implementation of the Public Audit Act? And what do you propose should be approaches and or strategies that will ensure successful implementation of these amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Honorable Morolong. Over to you, Ms. Maluleke.
Thank you, Honorable Morolong and Honorable Chair. The PAA implementation impediments would be in two buckets. And the first one is probably a little easier because I'm well attuned to it. The first bucket is about how the office deals with the PAA amendment. And I'll come to what I think the impediments might be and how we deal with it. The second one is about the other role players, because the instrument of these amendments is not one that seeks to drive consequence management purely by the Auditor General. It relies on the other complementary institutions around it to actually do their part as well. It relies on the executive authority to also act when things have gone wrong. That certificate of debt is not going to go anywhere unless the executive authority is also working with us, or it'll take a great deal of time for it to have an impact. It relies on the role of Parliament. It relies on the role of the investigations units, and as well as the prosecutorial units within society, within our system. So that second bucket is the one that we need to maybe spend a bit of time on. The first one, as I say, is a little bit easier. If I look at it, we needed to build capacity. We needed to make sure our people are trained. We've done that. That's not a problem because that was a change. We needed to make sure that our people buy into this because it's not an easy, a quick learning curve for them, and we had to implement this thing quickly. But we've done that because our teams are resilient and they're professionals, so I'm not too worried about that. What we'll need to make sure we do going forward is follow the MIs, the material irregularities identified right through the system. We also need to make sure that we follow the regulations that we've designed so that administrative justice is the norm in how we deal with this, so that we eliminate the potential for legal action that might constrain us in our quest to still do our audits and follow through on the material irregularities. We'd have to make sure that our quality control is intact, the audit quality, that is, so that the work that we do stands up to scrutiny and it supports those MIs that are delivered, because now the material irregularities really bite and they matter. So that by the time you issue remedial action, the work that on which it's informed is of high quality, done by people of integrity who are experienced to be dedicated to excellence. The second bucket is the one where we need to collaborate with other players. Make sure that the agreements, the collaborative agreements between us and the SIU or the NPA or the public protector are tight, and they are constantly managed as we learn, because we're going to learn and fine-tune our processes as we go. We're going to have to make sure that we don't rely only on this instrument and flood the system with MIs, because it's going to take a long time if we rely only on this system, on this instrument. It's going to take a long time to improve transparency, accountability, and consequence management in government. So our job, all of us, in terms of the role players in the complementary oversight mechanism, is to learn from each MI and go back and see what are the things in the system that need attention so that we can start to close the points of leakage. Thank you, Honorable Morolo.
Thank you very much, Ms. Maluleke. And it will take us now to the next Honorable Member, Buthelezi. Can you please pose your questions there? Over to you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam. Let me start where Honorable Singh stopped. Moral suasion has got its limit. This is about the transformation of the industry. So I would like to get from you, what do you think should be done to ensure that the private sector does not just pay lip service to transformation, but it walks the talk? Coupled with that, you are a former partner of one of the big auditing firms. As we are talking, we are the second most important individual at the office of the Auditor General. Please share with us your achievements and what you have done as far as transformation of the sector is concerned. This is an opportunity for you to go to town about it. But then I was just piggybacking on Honorable Singh as far as that one is concerned. But can you please address this one? What's your position as far as the AG doing auditing of the SOEs? As you know, the SOEs which are being audited by the private firms. What's your positions? And please talk to the advantages and disadvantages of the Auditor General getting involved there. And again, please just conclude and say what's your preference. And surely you'll also be motivating as far as that is concerned. Thank you very much. I will listen.
Thank you, Honorable Buthelezi. Ms. Maluleke, over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Buthelezi. Transformation is indeed a key aspect of how we're going to build an inclusive society, an inclusive economy, and therefore a sustainable society, one where there is a reduction in the inequalities, a reduction in unemployment, and I do believe that, and as well as a reduction in poverty. My understanding of transformation is really founded in the BE policy, and because it does bring key aspects that need to be implemented by corporate citizens if they are going to make a solid contribution to transformation. And it covers not just ownership, which is easy for people to focus on. But if you look at the policy and the codes of good practice around BEE, it covers employment equity, which is a key aspect around who manages, who controls, who's employed there, who's promoted, who's recruited. It covers skills development, who's being trained, who benefits from expenditure on training, and are these investments geared towards alleviating poverty, unemployment, and ultimately dealing with inequality. It deals with enterprise and supplier development. What are you doing in managing your value chain as an entity so that it ultimately transforms and gives space to the creation and development of black enterprises within your value chain, within your industry? It also deals with socioeconomic investments in different spaces. So I do believe that if an enterprise, if a private sector firm looks at that scorecard and takes it and actually implements it within its strategy, not as a piece that sits outside of the strategy of the institution, but they look at it as an integral part of their strategy. If they're thinking about supply chain, they think about transformation. If they're thinking about promotions, they think about transformation and not just worry about them when they not just worry about employment equity when they have to submit to the Department of Labor. So I do believe that if they think about it in that integrated fashion, they will be successful. And I agree with you, moral suasion is not going to win the game alone. It's an important part. We've got to have clear rules. We've got to make sure that we incentivize compliance. And I think the design of the BEE legislation allows for that. And we've got to make sure that when things are not being implemented in the way that they should be, we apply the consequences. And I think that's where we've not been so effective. Yes, as the DAG, I have prioritized this area because I feel very strongly about it. And I've played different roles throughout my career that have had something to do with transformation. So when I got there, I found an office 8 years ago. I found an office that was dedicated to transformation and doing extremely well in that regard, but wasn't measuring it. And I thought that if we measure it and we get a verification certificate, we can not just, we'll be able to talk about it in the public domain in a way that's convincing, but we can, it can add to the moral suasion of the private sector within our profession, because we can say, look, we are level two. What about you, Deloitte? We're level one. What about you, Deloitte? Which is where we are. When we started the journey of having our certificate done, we were at a level three, and that was a few years ago, and we've transitioned to level two and then to ultimately level one. These things don't happen overnight, and that's one thing I'm very clear about. And that's why you've got to put it as part of your strategy. It happens as a gradual process through consistent effort. We were fortunate as an audit office in that previous DAGs and previous AGs made it their business to implement transformation. Mine was to add on to it, and I believe that I've done that. If I look at employment equity statistics in our environment, our EXCO is more than 50% women, predominantly black. And that level of representation runs through the institution. The people that head key business units within our environment are predominantly black, and at least half female. So if you look at who heads up the Western Cape, it's a woman. Who heads up the KZN region, it's a woman. Who heads up the Eastern Cape, another woman. And these are women who were not flown into those roles. These are women who would have been recruited into different roles and developed over time. So such that when they arrive as executives, key executives who are leading key business units, they not only understand the institution, but they've built credibility internally. And again, that's critical because it's a gradual process, one that sets individuals up for failure, for success, I beg your pardon, that sets individuals up for success, that invests in their confidence and allows a demonstration that you can and you must have transformation walking alongside with delivery, performance, and excellence. Another thing I will brag about is that we have a training scheme that trains auditors. So aspiring auditors enter our environment on day one with a degree, and after 3 years, they have completed their work experience requirements to qualify as chartered accountants, and hopefully they've actually written their professional exams and can qualify as chartered accountants. And I've made changes working with the team over the last few years that have transformed that scheme. Again, building on what I found and using what I understood to be critical levers if we are going to shift the scheme in terms of the numbers of black professionals it delivers into the profession and into the public and private sectors as capable individuals. If we're going to shift the scheme into one that's characterized by individual and collective success. So we found that when the changes we've made have resulted in the office creating over 1,000 chartered accountants through its life, through its span, it's a 20-year-old scheme, over 1,000 chartered accountants created, black chartered accountants created through that scheme. And that's significant. Honorable Telezi, you would know the size of the profession and the representation of black people. 70% of those, so just over 700 of those, are African chartered accountants. just under 400 of those are African women chartered accountants. Now, that's a phenomenal contribution, not just to the individuals and their families, because they've been able to realize their personal ambitions in a way that changes their families forever, but to the office as well, and to the profession, and to the public sector, and to the private sector, because that's what happens. These young people end up building phenomenal careers elsewhere. So that's another area I will brag about, because it's something I feel very, very strongly about. And the scheme will continue, and we'll continue to look for improvements, and we'll continue to make sure that the office delivers candidates that are ready to write their board exams and succeed in that, and candidates that ultimately serve society in different roles wherever they may end up. Some we retain, but many go on to go and build phenomenal careers elsewhere. Another achievement that I must brag about is how we have used the lever of the work that we dish out to the private sector firms to transform the profession and to create opportunities for black practitioners to establish their businesses and to grow those businesses. Because that's what that ESD pillar is about. It's about making sure that you use your value chain to create these opportunities and to support the development of black firms. We've shifted the allocations of work to firms such that now, beg your pardon, such that now, of the 600 million rand that we dish out as part of our contract work allocation, 90% goes to level 1 and level 2 BEE contributors, 60% goes to black-owned firms, and almost 30% goes to black women-owned firms. Again, a phenomenal contribution, not just to the individuals that run those firms, but to the profession as well. So I'm extremely proud of what we've done with the team over the last few years, and it is my wish, and I'm actually confident that it'll happen, that that work continues, because it's one of the things that make up the nature of the office as a responsible corporate citizen. You were asking about the audit of state-owned entities, Honorable Teledi. I do believe that the office should audit these state-owned entities. Indeed, over the last few years, we've moved from auditing 3 of them to now auditing 14 of them, of the Schedule 2s, that is. And we are well on track to take on the remaining 2, which are Transnet and Eskom. And again, that had to be a gradual process. It wasn't something that would have been wise to do too quickly, because we had to build the capabilities within the office, build the skills, build the confidence of our teams, and manage the transition so that you don't shake the credibility of the product that we ultimately issue. The audits that we don't do yet, we have overseen much better, and we have gotten much closer to those auditors in a way that helps to drive not just the consistency of the work that we do, but I think the quality of the product that's ultimately issued by private sector auditors within the public sector has improved immensely because of our involvement. My preference is that we continue to audit these state-owned entities, even if we don't sign every single one ourselves, because it's good to share the load, it's good to share the responsibilities and have that interplay between private sector and public sector. But our involvement in those audits adds value, not just to our people whom we employ, who must have exciting opportunities to keep them in the office, but also to the auditees, because I think they get a much better product when we've partnered with the private sector firms, as well as to yourselves as public representatives who must oversee how those SOEs operate. So I'm not convinced that there are any cons to doing this work. It stretches us, but we're up to the task. And every single time we've taken on an SOE audit, our auditors do well, every single time. That is the excellence that sits within the office, and that's what we must preserve and continue to grow. So indeed, my preference is to continue on these audits, especially the ones that are more higher risk, and the ones where we are not yet ready to take over, we must remain working closer with the appointed private sector auditors. Thank you, Honorable Buthelezi.
Thank you very much, Ms. Maluleke. And we need to move now to Honorable Mende. for Honourable Mende to please pose your question. Over to you, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And Molo, Ms. Maluleke. Thank you for raising your hand and saying you are available. If opportunity is given to you, you'll take it. I'm particularly saying this because I see in the list here you are the only woman candidate we're interviewing. And hearing the strides that you're mentioning in relation to transformation, and especially where black women are concerned, it's quite impeccable. Now, we're not going to sit here and pretend that the hashtags don't exist. I won't mention the hashtags out there. And, Chair, just think 2 months ago, we know the levels of GBV that have been rising uncontrollable. So there was a case of rape of a two-year-old in a township. So the police station, in fact, Vispol head calls me, knowing we are members of parliament, we can intervene much quicker, calls me to say, I'm sitting with a problem here. There's a two-year-old being raped. The FCS, which is a unit which deals with such sensitive cases, is taking time to get here. I need your intervention. I intervene. I get to realize that the FCS investigator on standby is a woman, a very young one that just got introduced into the profession of the SAPS and being a detective. And you know how we always feel very happy that a woman is sensitive to such cases. But something immediately comes to mind, Chair, that it's about 11 at night. She's on standby. She has to drive into an informal settlement alone. I immediately revert back to the Vispol head that, no, allocate a sector van to her as well. She can't drive into that area with the perpetrator at large.
Yes.
I'm trying to paint a picture of the hashtags and the vulnerability of women still, even though we understand that we are taking up space, we are cementing ourselves into it, but there's a threat.
Yep.
You mentioned that you have 3 women and more hidden provinces, and yourself is a DAG. There are threats that you come across in a line of duty through ed auditing. These threats will come in various forms, especially because you are women. I would suppose that men only face one threat, suppose, I'm not so sure, but you have a double jeopardy situation where you will be facing a threat of being undermined. That's the first thing, to prove yourself that you can do it. Second thing, a threat of being bribed. Mm. That if you don't listen to me, I'm going to bribe you. If you can't, through undermining you, you might end up being raped. You might end up being followed into dark corners. You are here, you are a woman.
Mm.
And those things exist. Now, I'm wondering if you can share with us if the women in leadership with yourself through this career have ever come across such situations. How did you deal with them? And if you were to become now an auditor general, I understand being a DAG, you were very much involved in that kind of space as well. But now being an AG, if you are given an opportunity, how will you deal with such threats? But that also coupled with the general intimidation that comes from all departments, in fact, anyone who's being audited, refusing to give you financial statements to such an extent that currently the AG had to take various departments to court simply because of CRED's refusal to be audited. And now it's going to be aggravated by the fact that we know how the world will live in, that you're going to be a woman.
Yeah.
There's going to be that element. There is that element already that's happening, but now, being a woman, how are you going to deal with this situation? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mente. Ms. Takanya, can you please respond?
Thank you, Honorable Mente and Honorable Chair. Indeed, Honorable Mende, women are much more vulnerable, and as women in leadership, we're sensitive to it. We've dealt with this issue in the same way as we've dealt with how we generally keep our staff safe in the context of threats and intimidation. And the things we've done, and I would continue to do as Auditor General if I'm appointed, would be about, first of all, making sure that our people understand the need to be alert and vigilant in monitoring what's happening. So we've had an incident where one of our female executives was followed in one of the provinces about 2 years ago. And she got so frightened. Fortunately, she was alert to it, and she drove to a police station. But she got so frightened, she ultimately resigned. So the threat is to individuals, and if you can keep them safe, thankfully, it's also a threat to the capability of the office. Because when a key executive resigns, you lose capability, and it is quite disruptive. So the focus on keeping people safe is one that has to remain. And it would be about making sure people are vigilant. Let me just go back a step. Making sure they are vigilant and they are aware. Making sure they take steps of don't travel alone at night. Don't go to an order site on your own. Don't go in a marked vehicle that demonstrates who you are. So all those precautions that they can take. But also we work with the provincial commissioners of police, where they are able to highlight to us before our audit team goes into any environment whether there are specific threats that they've identified. That's the first thing. But second of all, if our people pick up anything, they're able to raise it with the police. And the truth is that we've gotten very good support out of the SAPS throughout most of the provinces. The third thing we would do is continue to advocate for all people who interact with the state or are employed within the state to uphold their responsibility as set out in the Constitution, to protect the institution, to protect its ability to execute on its mandate, and to assist the office in the way as AG Magwetu has done in elevating this risk to SCOAG and getting SCOAG support in addressing it. So those things I would most certainly continue to do. The other thing that I would do is continue the journey of educating South Africans more broadly about what the office does and the value of the office to society, so that individuals within communities understand the importance of keeping our staff safe, understand the importance of safeguarding this office, which is there for their benefit. So I think that's the one part I would add on to it, to drive visible engagement with society about the role and the value of the office to society, so that there is some ownership by a broader range of stakeholders in society for protecting this office. Thank you, Honorable Mente.
Thank you very much on your response. We're now going to call upon Honorable Dlakude, who is one of us in the platform. Honorable Dlakude, can you please pose your question? Honorable Deputy Chief Whip, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good afternoon, Ms. Maluleka. Honorable Maluleka, Let me take this opportunity to say I'm proud to have you as a woman being part of the of the candidates we are interviewing today. You are the first, as Comrade Mentor has already alluded to. Hopefully the next candidate is also a woman. Ms. Maluleka, you'll agree with me that corruption is the third pandemic in our country, and it's a serious threat to our constitutional democracy. As I said that, we know that as human beings, we also have our own limitations, and so are institutions like this one of the Office of the Auditor General. As an individual, if I may start with you, do you have any shortcomings as a woman? And if so, do you think that those shortcomings will hamper you, your ability into doing your work if appointed as an auditor general? And also, do you really, do you have, what is it that you are doing to make sure that you deal with those shortcomings, if there are any? Then my question with regard to the institution, which is the Auditor General's office, is that there are limitations. There are limitations which prevent the Office of the Auditor General to conduct the full scope of its audit. What are those limitations, and how would you ensure that the Office of the Auditor General or the Auditor General of South Africa conduct the full scope of performance audit despite those limitations? Honorable Chairperson, thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Chief Whip. Can we allow Honourable Ms. Maluleke to please respond to the question? Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Deputy Chief Whip. I'm going to suggest that I'd rather not look up at the screen, but look at the members that are here. It might be a little bit awkward. As an individual, what shortcomings do I have, and do I think they would stop me from doing my job if I'm appointed as Auditor General? I think the critical shortcomings that I have are really about how I can sometimes come across. I'm an introvert in nature, and not everyone knows that, but I am. And that can sometimes make me seem dismissive and inaccessible because I live often in my head. And I'm well aware that is something I have to keep working on, because as Auditor General, you engage with a much broader range of stakeholders than what I've done up until now, and it's something that I would continue to have to develop. I don't believe that it's an impediment that would make life difficult. It's something that I can overcome. The second thing is I tend to be quite passionate about certain things, transformation being one of them. And in my journey growing as a leader, I am learning that it's unhelpful to forget that transformation is a contested space. As you deal with transformation, it's not always obvious to people why it's important. And not because cognitively they don't get it, but because they sit in their corner and they are marking a score sheet that says, okay, if a woman's being appointed, it means there's less for us as men. If a black person's appointed, it's less for us as white people. if a Musutu is appointed, then it's less for us as Batsonga. It's those sorts of things. People tend not to see that. And I have learned that I need to spend more time engaging with those that feel hard done by as I blaze a trail on transformation. Because it's not that they are against transformation, but it's because as individuals, people sit in their corner and they feel like they are losing something when we are driving a transformation agenda. So it's something I've learned to embrace as an area where I must slow down, I must talk to people much more consistently. I would do it once off and move on. But the costs of transformation sometimes hit you later and in ways you don't anticipate. So again, I don't think it's a matter that would make it difficult for me to fulfill my duties as Auditor General should I be appointed. From a technical point of view, I don't see any impediments. From a practical point of view, I don't see any impediments. Yes, there hasn't been a female that has fulfilled this role, but I think by now we have proven that women can play these leadership roles in different spaces. And often they do a pretty good job of it because they know that their success is so important for the generation of women that follows them. Certainly that's been what has informed my journey as DAG, knowing that I'm the first Deputy Auditor General. It was important for me to make good on the promise of women leadership for the benefit of the institution, of the people within it, and ultimately for the people of South Africa. The impediments or limitations of the office in terms of fulfilling its mandate, the full scope of its audit, and specifically on performance audit, and how do I address them? One of the critical impediments for the office to do its work is around audit fee affordability, the ability of auditees to afford our fees and ultimately pay for the service we provide. Yes, we can continue to manage efficiencies internally. Yes, we can continue to contain what we pass on to the fiscus. But that limitation will continue because the fiscus itself is under pressure. So we have to think about the appropriateness of the audit scope in different areas. It is my belief that there is an opportunity, a timely and urgent opportunity that we must grab for the office to think differently about how we audit some of the smaller entities, such as the municipalities that are distressed, such as the museums. And to do that, we'd have to work in concert with the standard setter, the owner of the reporting frameworks, the Office of the Accountant General, so that we agree on this idea that the City of Joburg and its reporting, financial reporting and performance reporting obligations must be distinct from the audit of Maludiapufung. That municipality is small, it is under distress, and there's relative chaos there. And we have to figure out how you balance the need to manage transparency and accountability such that that's never compromised, but manage a journey that is consistent with the environment that's there. And I think through collaboration, through effective collaboration, we can take on this task and we can win. I really do believe that. On performance audits themselves, the pressures on the fiscus to pay for performance audits will continue. What we've done over time is we've put the performance audit machinery as part of our annual regularity audits. So what you see as members of parliament who are charged with oversight in our annual audit report is the outcome of an integrated audit approach. We've essentially built a practice over the last few years where we bring on the diversity of skills into our audit. So that essentially the performance audit insights you seek, you're able to find in the context of the regularity audit. It has enriched our work. It has allowed stakeholders to see the link between internal controls and the impact on citizens. When we tell the stories in the general report, when the AG tables it, those stories come out of us having created this multidisciplinary team approach that incorporates performance audit, investigations, information systems audits, as well as the regularity audits. And my sense is that there is still scope for us to do even more of that in a way that doesn't drive standalone audit fee that's additional to the annual regularity fee that we're charging to particular auditees. And I'm not saying that there's no scope to do any performance audits. There is still scope. My preoccupation over the last few years, together with the team and together with the AG, has been about integrating these disciplines to create better value. And I would want to continue with that journey if I'm appointed Auditor General, at least for the short term. Longer range, we would then work on shorter, punchier performance audits that are targeted and informed by key questions that we've researched appropriately, acting in concert with not just the auditees and Parliament as oversight, but also with civil society to figure out what are the key questions we need to be answering and rather have shorter, timely, more frequent, punchier performance audits that are affordable. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Maluleke. We now go over to Honourable Smith for her to ask her question. Over to you, Honourable Smith. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Ms. Maluleke. The reports that of the Auditor General that are tabled in Parliament are the compilation of the various business units within the Auditor General. And allow me to say I'm actually welcoming the fact that you shared the information that most of the business units are run by women. That's very welcoming to hear. If you were to be the successful candidate for the post, how would you as the Auditor General ensure that those reports are credible and reliable?
Thank you, Honourable Speaker. Ms. Maluleke, can you please respond to the question? Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honourable Talashe. Thank you, Honourable Spies. The Auditor General's reports indeed must remain credible and a credible, independent, reliable source of insights to those that run government, that oversee government, and to citizens more broadly. The things that make that possible are an independent mindset in how we conduct our work, ethical behavior that informs how the work is done and the behavior of the people doing that work, and following the international audit standards that have become a feature within the office. I would want to sustain that if I'm appointed as Auditor General. I would also want to make sure that our teams remain in touch with the reality of South Africans, the lived experience of South Africans, so that we don't run so far on a theoretical exercise of the reports that's consistent and compliant with standards, but then lose the essence of what is troubling South Africans. So I will continue on that journey of bringing to bear in our risk assessments before we do the audits, in our analysis of the outcomes of an audit, the insights that come from other players. And to do that, I would have to collaborate effectively with civil society, once again, with academia, because there's a lot of research that's available, and also just with other reports that tell us what's happening in communities. The other part I would do is make sure our guys go visit the audit sites more regularly than just at the year end. So I would make sure that audit standards are maintained, ethical conduct and independent posture remains. I would make sure that we are close enough to the auditee to understand exactly what they do so that our work is relevant and relatable. And to do that is about proximity, is about consistent attention to other information that is available from other role players. There's a unique opportunity, Honourable Speaker, right now in society where I do get the sense that it is timely for the Office of the Auditor General to work more closely with civil society than what we have done up until now. And we're seeing that that work come to bear in the recent audits that we're doing. And I would want to make good on this opportunity that we have now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Maluleke. We're now coming back to Honourable Vessels for him to pose the question.
Thank you, Chairperson. Sorry. Have you ever come across a situation in your years of involvement and your career where the demands of a stakeholder conflicted with your ethical values or those of the organization where you were involved in, or the principles and standards of corporate governance? And how did you address it? And how will you address it? And then on the same, in the same line, stakeholder relations are also very important in terms of the Auditor General's office. And given those sometimes conflicting demands and also unreasonable demands of stakeholders, how will you manage stakeholder relations if you were appointed as the AG? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Vessels. Ms. Maluleke, can you please respond to the question?
Stand it again. The application of known audit standards throughout the office by all the professionals charged with actually conducting the office is something that we have to sustain, because that is what informs the credibility of the work that's done by the professionals that are in the office. The AG doesn't sign every individual audit report. He delegates to professionals who are qualified auditors who have the responsibility to do their risk assessment, to resource their audit teams, to conduct the work, to report on it, to apply the established quality control on their audit report. So that needs to remain in terms of keeping the sanctity of that audit process intact. And I think that's what helps, even in the context of managing difficult stakeholders or conflict with stakeholders when it arises, because the person doing the work is close enough to the audit and is given the space, the resources, the rules, and the authority to sign off on that audit in the best way that defines, that is informed by the work that they've done. We then also have a quality control monitoring process that makes sure that keeps the quality control intact. When a stakeholder complains, somebody independent of that audit team takes another look and sees if they arrive at the same conclusion. And if they do, the matter then rests. The team was right. And I found that stakeholders respect us for maintaining the line of our professionalism. Yes, we must engage with stakeholders. Yes, we must respond to them as our key stakeholders and audit clients. But our responsibility is to conduct the work faithfully, to report courageously on the things that we've done. So that's what I found throughout my time at the Office of the AG. There was an instance about 5 years ago where a particular auditee fell out with the audit team. So the CEO of this particular entity was particularly aggrieved with our team. And he made a lot of noise and you know, wrote a long letter of complaint. And in that complaint is stuff about, oh, but your team doesn't know how to behave, and oh, but your team, you know, they are wrong on this. And in that noise, I was then able to step in, because as DAG, I don't really get involved in too much of the detail of an audit, only if there's a problem. So here was a problem. Again, I was able to do two things. Keep the AG and available to deal with the matter if I fail, so that there's an escalation process that's available to that stakeholder. Deal with it myself, because I'm not in that audit team, so I'm kind of neutral from the audit team. But assert at all times the integrity of the audit process. So engage with the team about, look, what happened here? And listen to the stakeholder about, what are you raising? And find the line of, what is it that we can resolve without ever flouting audit standards, without ever crossing the line around ethical conduct, without ever losing sight of what our purpose is? And how do we resolve the matter? So in this instance, when people have fallen out and the heat is billowing, you know, people lose sight of what the essence of the trouble is on both sides. And so as a neutral party, I was able to navigate it and say, look, this is what we can do to fix this is the adjustment you must make. Audit team, will you be happy? And that's not my decision. It is yours, because you are the delegated signatory to this report. And if this adjustment is made, what does the report look like? Again, I don't decide on it, but I allow the team the space to do that. Mine is to navigate the space of saying, let's just hear you out as a stakeholder. Let's try and resolve the conflict at best. But we must never compromise on our ethical values or our audit standards.
Thank you very much, Ms. Maluleke, on your responses. As you would know, Ms. Maluleke, that the process has been so transparent, such that when we concluded the shortlisting, we put your names for public comments. And in your case, ma'am, the public did respond to you as one of the candidates, and they put some discomforting things about you. As the committee, we think it's important for us to hear from you directly. Of course, not taking away the request we made earlier on to say, please put that in writing so that we can have it in our records. I'm giving you now that opportunity to please talk to us in confidence on what is reflecting from the public about yourself, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I want to thank the committee for giving me an opportunity to see those two comments in particular that you are concerned about, because it does allow me to deal with it now. I will still give the written submission. My understanding is that there are these two comments. There was one from Ms. Ruth Chauke regarding CIPC, and the other comment was from a gentleman based in Cape Town, I think it's Mahlangu, who had a concern about my stance on the profession and the training scheme. It is just those two, if I may just confirm. If I may start with Ms. Chauke. Indeed, she raises a concern that she submitted a whistleblower report to us, or a complaint to our office, asking us to investigate a number of allegations that she was raising of things that had happened at the CIPC, which is an entity within the DTI portfolio. In her complaint, she was concerned about the behavior of different players. We looked at this request to investigate, and we decided not to investigate because we consulted with the audit team. We looked at the substance of the matters raised. We looked at the audit matters, the things that are we are geared to respond to as an audit office, and we responded to Ms. Chauke on that, and ultimately decided we are not going to do an investigation. And we wrote her a letter to that effect back in December of 2019. Earlier this year, she wrote asking for an investigations report. My response to her was that we have not done an investigation, as we indicated to you in December, so there is no report to give to you. She kept insisting that there is a report. And my sense was, well, we don't have a report, perhaps somebody else has investigated, it may be better for you to ask whomever is indicating to you that there is an investigation to help you get hold of such a report. What I learned from her letter to yourself is that, one, she remains aggrieved as a whistleblower, and I think we have to contend with that. Two is that there is new information that she is raising that she had not raised before, such as the outcome of an investigation she had asked for at the Office of the Public Protector. So a combination of those two things, the fact that she remains aggrieved as a whistleblower on the one hand, and that there's new information on the other hand, compels me to request permission from yourselves at the appropriate time to engage with her, if it's at all possible, so that we can figure out how, jointly with the other parties that she feels have investigated or should be investigating, we can address her concern. Because in her correspondence, there are things she asked the DG of DTI to deal with, as well as the Audit Committee of CIPC. There are things she asked the AG to deal with, and there are things she asked the Public Protector to deal with. So my view is that given that there's new information she's raising, given that she remains aggrieved, and one doesn't want to discourage whistleblowers from taking the opportunity to raise a flag when they believe there's a problem, it's incumbent on all these parties that I've mentioned, the AG, the Public Protector, as well as the leadership of CIPC and DTI, to see how we can help to close the matter so that she gains closure. It may well be that we're never able to close it with her and give her a satisfactory answer, but I think we should give her an opportunity to look at it one more time. I don't believe that there's anything more I can add to that, Honorable Tolashe. I think my understanding of it is that she remains aggrieved and believes that there is a report. Unfortunately, we don't have such a report, and I'm happy for us to deal with it subsequent to this interview process. The second one, around the profession. I note that the gentleman is an audit activist, so he's somebody who's very interested in the audit profession. He has an understanding of the audit profession, and he has certain concerns about transformation, about the accreditation of professional bodies by IRBA, the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors. Again, I would hate to dismiss what he's raising. I think as an interested player, it would be important for us to work with him to see how we can support transformation within the audit profession. The facts, Chair, are that SAICA, which I'm a member of, is the most highly recognized professional accountancy professional body within the profession in South Africa. There are others. That's the one part. IRBA is an independent regulatory board of auditors. They accredit professional bodies. I don't believe that it's for the AG to lobby IRBA to accredit. However, we can have a conversation on how the office supports professional bodies to be accredited by IRBA so that they train auditors. At the moment, only SAICA is registered accredited with IRBA. The ACCA has applied to IRBA, I remember that from many years ago, to be accredited, and they've not yet been accredited. When the time arises, happy to work with them to see how we can support the entry of more people into the ACCA band and the advancement of black accountants. The one thing, though, Chair, I think I must raise on this one is that in the journey towards transformation, and maybe this is where I'm too passionate about these things, in the journey towards transformation, standards must never be compromised. And my preference is informed by what I've seen happen over many years in the profession, where we've been able to transform but never shifting the standards. So there's one board exam that everyone writes, And if there are problems with a pass rate for black candidates, let's figure it out. Let's sort out whatever it is that's making it difficult for them to pass, but you keep the standard the same. So if there's a professional body that's battling to be accredited by IRPA, I do believe we should work with them to figure out how we bring them up to the standard rather than dropping the standard. What we've done in the training scheme is focus on maintaining the standard and supporting those who aspire to become registered auditors, professional auditors, members of a professional body in the accountancy domain to realize the ambition. And that is what the essence of what happened in the office around SAICA. So my bias is to standards, and my bias is to helping young people realize their personal goals and not normalize abandoning those goals that they've set for themselves. So that's the essence of the issue. But I'm happy to give a written submission to yourselves.
Thank you.
Okay, Honourable Vessels. In that order, please, Honourable Members.
Thanks, Chair. Very short, Ms. Maluleke. We understand that you've issued findings in terms of audit for all three spheres. There's rather a very dim, problematic picture. And I would now imagine the number of certificates in terms of what you've identified as the irregular expenditures or practice, which then will lead to you issuing certificates and all of that. Now, there is this tendency in South Africa, which is it's a pandemic, I would call it, that we either take each other to court just to delay processes, or we shift people around. The person, the nice thing about the certificate, it follows you wherever you go. But we just shift people around just to lose focus. We mess up with evidence. It's done with by department. Now, when you get to that stage where you are delayed tactfully through the measures I've mentioned, what is going to be your next step should you be in AG? Because there must be a way of stopping it. It must not be allowed that you are going to be delayed throughout. You have a time frame for certificate. You have a time frame for whatever process has to be followed by the three spheres and where you have identified all these elements of corruption and irregularities. But that time frame must never be lost. And with you not losing it as an AG, if you become one, it means your defense mechanism in terms of challenging the departments at court if they then use that to delay you is on par. And it's not going to mess around with you with something that you should have finished within 2 years. You end up having to finish it within 5 years. Then things are overtaken by events. The whole country ends up forgetting that 500 billion has been stolen. Now something new is happening. What I'm trying to ask is, what are you going to do to make sure that everything is finished within the time frame and no delay tactics? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Menke. The next Honorable Member.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I'm back, Ms. Maluleke. Perhaps let me just, for information, the percentage of your revenue that which comes from the transfers from the fiscals and what you raise from the audit fees. Coupled with that, I would like to know what is it that you would have loved to do were you going to, if you had more resources that you are not able to do at the moment. That's one. But Chairperson, I also wanted to comment on what you have just said on the question that was raised by the Chairperson. One, do you have jurisdiction over IRBA, except for auditing? Two, you were asking us to say go and do something, I think, as far as Mr. Chauke or Ms. Chauke is, Ms. Chauke is concerned. Chairperson, we are not going to ask you to do things here. You know what your work is. We don't want you to come out of this and say, this committee, what we are doing here, what we are doing with you here is to is an interview. So as to what you do and so on, it definitely it can't be us who tell you what to do. So you know what statutory you can do, and it's not the work of this committee. All what we wanted to get from your side was the explanation, a response to the issues which have been raised by the public. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Buthelezi. Can I go to Honorable Singh?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, it's that part of the evening. I'm trying to lay my hands on an email here, which came as anonymous. Somebody said I want to remain anonymous, but they mentioned the email. I don't know if Ms. Maluleka was responding to that particular email. It was about racism and not giving opportunities, because you mentioned the name. Okay. It came, it says, I want to remain anonymous, but I saw that the person had an email address. We will consider it later if we... It didn't mean much when I read it, but I know I had it in my file. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Singh. Honorable Vessels.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Very quick question. Would you say that there is too much emphasis currently on compliance rather than performance? And in the same breath, do you think our scope currently with regard to the standard which are obtained or which should be maintained to obtain a clean audit or unqualified audit is sufficient in the current circumstances? Is there a need for a new definition of a clean audit that also takes service delivery into account and value for money into account? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Vessels. Ms. Maluleke, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the Honorable Members for the questions. If I could just start with Honorable Mente, how do you deal with the potential for delaying tactics in the implementation of the Act as amended? Indeed, there is a risk that accounting officers or executive authorities may move people around or delay action on the matter. We've tried hard to cater for that in shaping the Act and the regulations that inform it. To give the AG discretion to decide on the time frames within which a response must come and to be reasonable about it, given the matter at hand. So my undertaking is to implement those regulations as set out and to continue to refine them if we find that there is still far too much shifting away from consequences in that regard. So we'll learn out of this new... The phase one that we've just implemented for PFMA and MFMA, and we'll continue to refine. So that's what I would do. Implement the regulations as they've been designed, because they're supposed to achieve a healthy balance between administrative justice and speed and effectiveness of the instrument. We'll refine them as we go, once we've seen how things work. If there's a concern, I would certainly elevated to SCOAG, with whom the regulations would be engaged upon anyway. My dedication, if I'm appointed AG, my dedication will be to make sure that that instrument is implemented in a way that achieves the intent of the legislators at the time that they approved this legislation. Honorable Buthelezi, quick question to the Irba one. No, we don't have jurisdiction over Irba. And my response was about saying we wouldn't lobby Irba to get them to do what the writer wants. But if there is a professional body that's on a journey towards accreditation by Irba, if there's a professional body that's needing support from us, where appropriate, we would lend that support in the way that we've done for ACCA and for SIGA as an employer and a training office. Financial constraints. At the moment, we only get audit fees. The funding model and the legislation allows for us to have audit fees to raise funding through an appropriation and perhaps even donations if it is appropriate. We haven't used any of the latter two instruments. There is a process in place right now to see if we can get an appropriation for the implementation of the PAA. However, we have only been getting 100% through audit fees. What can we not spend on? One of the things that we would have loved to spend on, Honorable Buthelezi, is on audit software. It might sound quite operational, but it's a big story in our office. It's one of those things where if we had unlimited resources, that's what we would do for our auditors, get them new audit software. Unfortunately, the scale of the cost is so big that we have to be conservative and try and build up resources and space to actually do that. And I think we were doing pretty well at that, and then COVID, and we had to use the cash resources that we had built up through our cash margin of safety to survive the implications of this COVID and the lockdown. So that's what I would do if we had unlimited funds. That would be the first urgent matter to deal with, get our auditors new, responsive, appropriate audit software that makes them efficient. It's been a plea since I've been in the office, and it's one we've been constrained to deal with because of financial resources. Honorable Singh, the letter you referred to is not the letter I was referring to is not the one that you're referring to. This gentleman mentioned his name, so the letter sent to me had an individual with a name and an address, and that's the one I was referring to. So the anonymous one, I'm unaware of. The last one, Honorable Vessels, is there too much of an emphasis on compliance vis-a-vis performance? In some spaces, and I don't think it's by design. It's about how the implementation actually happens. So I don't believe that there is a need to review the clean audit definition. There is a need to refine the framework around performance information. There is a need to refine the compliance burden and the reporting burden, especially for the smaller entities. But broadly, I don't believe the definition of a clean audit is inappropriate. It is certainly consistent with what the audit office has been designed to do and what sits in the Public Audit Act, which is that we must look at financial information and its credibility, usefulness of performance information, and compliance in terms of whether or not public entities have run their affairs in a manner that's consistent with the laws of the country. So I wouldn't change that, but I would look at specific areas for improvement, such as the performance information framework and how we audit it, and the scope for reporting and for auditing for the smaller auditees. I'm done, Honorable Talashe.
Thank you very much, Ms. Maluleka. Honorable Singh, do you want to come back on the anonymous?
Yes, Chairperson. I've located the narrative on this matter. It came from our researchers who did a summary of all the comments on each of the candidates. And I'll just read the paragraph as they had noted it. But when I read it, I know it came from Anonymous, but there was a name to the email. So I suppose we know who sent it. It says, and I'm putting it to you because I think it's only fair that Ms. Maluleka responds. Lastly, it is alleged that Ms. Maluleka failed to deal with the allegations of racism within the Auditor General of South Africa. It is alleged that employees who raise issues of subtle racism have either been subjected to punitive actions by the office or treated as troublemakers. Therefore, Ms. Maluleka, as an accounting officer at AXA, she has presided over a grievance process which is rooted in unfair discrimination based on skin color. To substantiate this, it is alleged that she unfairly dismissed one of the complainants of racism, which he or she later won the appeal in the labor court. I don't know if you remember this, but it came to us. So that's all.
Thank you very much, Honorable Singh. Would you want to respond, Ms. Maluleka, on the matter? Please come forward. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honorable. Implementation of the Act as amended. Indeed, there is a risk that accounting officers or executive authorities may move people around or delay action on the matter. We've tried hard to cater for that in shaping the Act and the regulations that inform it. To give the AG discretion to decide on the time frames within which a response must come and to be reasonable about it, given the matter at hand. So my undertaking is, my dedication, if I'm appointed AG, my dedication will be to make sure that that instrument is implemented in a way that achieves the intent of the legislators at the time that they approved this legislation. Honourable Buthelezi, quick question to the IRBA one. No, we don't have jurisdiction over IRBA. And my response was about saying we wouldn't lobby IRBA to get them to do what the writer wants. But if there is a professional body that's on a journey towards accreditation by IRBA, if there's a professional body that's needing support from us, where appropriate, we would lend that support in the way that we've done for ACCA and for SAIGA as an employer and a training office. Financial constraints. At the moment, we only get audit fees. The funding model and the legislation allows for us to have audit fees to raise funding through an appropriation, and perhaps even donations if it is appropriate. We haven't used any of the latter two instruments. There is a process in place right now to see if we can get an appropriation for the implementation of the PAA. However, we have only been getting 100% through audit fees. What can we not spend on? One of the things that we would have loved to spend on, Honourable Buthelezi, is on audit software. It might sound quite operational, but it's a big story in our office. It's one of those things where if we had unlimited resources, that's what we would do for our auditors, get them new audit software. Unfortunately, the scale of the cost is so big that we have to be conservative and try and build up resources and space to actually do that. And I think we were doing pretty well at that, and then COVID, and we had to use the cash resources that we had built up through our cash margin of safety to survive the implications of this COVID and the lockdown. So that's what I would do if we had unlimited funds. That would be the first urgent matter to deal with, get our auditors new responses, appropriate audit software that makes them efficient. It's been a plea since I've been in the office, and it's one we've been constrained to deal with because of financial resources. Honourable Singh, the letter you referred to is not the letter I was referring to is not the one that you're referring to. This gentleman mentioned his name, so the letter sent to me had an individual with a name and an address, and that's the one I was referring to. So the anonymous one, I'm unaware of. The last one, Honourable Vessels, is there too much of an emphasis on compliance vis-a-vis performance in some spaces? And I don't think it's by design. It's about how the implementation actually happens. So I don't believe that there is a need to review the clean audit definition. There is a need to refine the framework around performance information. There is a need to refine the compliance burden and the reporting burden, especially for the smaller entities. But broadly, I don't believe the definition of a clean audit is inappropriate. It is certainly consistent with what the audit office has been designed to do and what sits in the Public Audit Act, which is that we must look at financial information and its credibility, usefulness of performance information, and compliance in terms of whether or not public entities have run their affairs in a manner that's consistent with the laws of the country. So I wouldn't change that, but I would look at specific areas for improvement, such as the performance information framework and how we audit it, and the scope for reporting and for auditing for the smaller auditees. I'm done, Honourable Talashe.
Thank you very much, Ms. Maluleka. Honorable Singh, do you want to come back on the anonymous?
Yes, Chairperson. I've located the narrative on this matter. It came from our researchers who did a summary of all the comments on each of the candidates. And I'll just read the paragraph as they had noted it. But when I read it, I know it came from anonymous, but there was a name to the email. So I suppose we know who sent it. It says, and I'm putting it to you because I think it's only fair that Ms. Maluleka responds. Lastly, it is alleged that Ms. Maluleka failed to deal with the allegations of racism within the Auditor General of South Africa. It is alleged that employees who raise issues of subtle racism have either been subjected to punitive actions by the office or treated as troublemakers. Therefore, Ms. Maluleka, as an accounting officer at AXA, she has presided over a grievance process which is rooted in unfair discrimination based on skin color. To substantiate this, it is alleged that she unfairly dismissed one of the complainants of racism, which he or she later won the appeal in the labor court. I don't know if you remember this, but it came to us. So that's all.
Thank you very much, Honorable Singh. Would you want to respond, Ms. Maluleka, on the matter? Please come forward. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honorable Singh and Honorable Chair. The story rings a bell, and I think I understand exactly the space within which it came. There was a grievance against one of the executives responsible for a particular business unit, and the people within that business unit collaborated on a group grievance, which went through the channels, and I'm the last individual within the office to deal with it. Once I've dealt with the grievance process as per our policy, and if somebody is unhappy with the outcome, they can go to the CCMA or the Labor Court, and that happens as a matter of course. And I did deal with this matter because the grievance process went through two other executives before me, and when it came before me, I arrived at the same conclusion that they had. And my view was that there was something else going on which needed attention. There was a leadership issue, there was a team dynamic issue, and there was an insecurity issue about us wanting to employ people from outside of that team so that we could extend the capabilities of the office and the skill set of the office, because we didn't have the skills required to respond to the risks we were assessing in the environment that we audited in, as well as respond to the provisions of the Public Audit Act, because you could see where this was going. And we identified that this space needed to be upskilled urgently. So we didn't have the skills. We had to go seek elsewhere. In my engagement with that group, it became quite clear that there was a leadership issue, as I say, and the individual we allowed to go for coaching and supported her in shaping how she can lead better. I think all of us always have things we can do better. So that's how I certainly analyze the problem. The second one was about the team dynamics. She was a new leader in that business unit, and she was struggling to gain acceptance by the people who were already there. And then the third part was about introducing new skills. And there was a sense among some of them that if you are appointing people from outside, what about us? And my conversations with them, and it wasn't just once, was saying, we've got to respond to the need of the office. Yours is to work with us in upskilling you. So these people that are experts, that have skills you don't have, you must work with them to upskill yourself as well. And whatever you need to do, we will support you, because developing you so that you're ready the next time these opportunities come, we hold very seriously. The manager that ultimately was dismissed took his matter to the CCMA, not to the Labor Court, and it was settled on the basis that the allegations he was making were not valid. There wasn't a labor court action, and there was no decision against the organization in the labor court, as is alleged in there. So I remember the story well, Honorable Singh. It's really consistent with what I said earlier on, that I'm learning that transformation is a tough journey, and one's got to continue to engage, not just once or twice, but on an ongoing basis. And some of the costs hit you later and in unexpected ways. So that's where I would put that issue.
Thank you very much, Ms. Maluleka. Any follow-up question on this matter, I'm going to give Honorable Morolong here the question.
Yes, no, Chairperson, it's not going to be a long question. I concur with Honorable Mutelezi that we are in no position to tell you what to do about these allegations. Our sole interest is on the occurrences thereof and how these issues were handled. But I think we will be remiss in our responsibilities as public representatives if we are not to speak strongly about the protection of whistleblowers. And I'm going to suggest that in your response to us, now that you have alluded to the fact that there's new information, that you expound on how you intend to deal with this matter going forward, so that there's comfort that we are going to do our best to protect whistleblowers. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Morolong. We're now going back to Ms. Tsakani. And Honorable Member, this will be the last question. Over to you, ma'am.
The one from Honorable Morolong. Thank you. I understood that you were asking for me to respond in writing on how I deal with the protection of whistleblowers, and not just I, but as an office, because
precisely,
it was an office decision. I've heard that and I've understood it, and will certainly, most certainly respond. It may not be by tomorrow, Honourable Chair, because on this matter I would have to work in concert with the Auditor General and ensure that we are aligned, and that which I undertake to do is, or what we undertake to do as an office, is consistent with what he would have it be, for he remains in control of the office and is ultimately accountable for how it runs. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Maluleka. I think Honourable Member is satisfied with your response, and that brings us to the end of the interview. On behalf of the committee, Ms. Maluleka, let me take this opportunity to thank you for having, as Honourable said earlier on, you raised your hand in wanting to serve the nation. And good about you, you're the only woman who have done that. We hope you spoke extensively about transformation and the progress thereof while putting our eyes on yourself to be able to bring more of them to the fore, so that by the time you leave the office, you would leave a very good legacy. We really thank you for having responded to all the questions without fear, no prejudice. We're here to make sure that you get the best candidate of as AG, as you have created a very solid, the office has created a very solid base as AG in South Africa in particular, for us to be able to be proud of it. To date, it's one of the offices that is the best. Thank you very much. As you have been articulating your responses, we have been part of that. Siyabulela kakhulu sisi, uhambe kahle.
Enkosi, Honorable Tolashe, enkosi to the Honorable Members, Nakhe Shinene, enkomo.
Thank you.